Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C. Sam Matekane, Lesotho's new prime minister, promises to run his administration like a business.
I'm going to run Lesotho exactly as I used to run my businesses. I'm telling you, my wish is to turn Lesotho around, and it's going to happen.
The U.S.-Africa Leadership Summit ends in Washington, D.C.
One of the things that's been great is that we're looking at a new way of engaging, new forms of partnerships between America and African states. And that's a new form of partnership based on a shared vision, based on trust, based on mutual accountability.
And the presidential candidate of the Opposition Action Alliance says the party policies and growing popularity will ensure victory in Nigeria's coming February general election. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Sam Matekane, the newly installed Prime Minister of Lesotho, says he plans to run his administration like a business and hold the government accountable. A prominent business magnate, Matekane also promises to implement policies that he says will improve the living conditions of the people. The Prime Minister, who is in Washington to participate in the U.S.-Africa Leadership Summit, also met U.S. lawmakers on the sidelines of the meeting. In an exclusive interview with VOA, Prime Minister Matekane says he has a social contract with citizens that he says will make the Kingdom of Lesotho great again. Here is part one of my interview.
Lesotho is a democratic, sovereign, and politically and socially stable country located in Southern Africa. And I must say Lesotho is ready for business. Yeah. Lesotho has got an attractive investment destination, government and administered incentives for investors. In manufacturing, infrastructure, factory shells, and so on. We got some youthful, skilled, illiterate workforce, market opportunities for investors to export from Lesotho to Southern African Customs Union, which is SACU. African free trade area as well. Now I'll tell you a little bit about AGOA. Where are the opportunities for that? Is that you can send your stuff to China, Canada, EU, Australia, New Zealand, and some preferential market across access. Yeah. Tourism as well. We got the skiing mountains. You can ski. You can ride bicycles on the mountains. We got a lot of water in abundance, which we can do anything with that water. You can always... I can just say it's a competitive advantage that we have in Lesotho, where you can do anything as you wish. The altitude, the mountains, the water resources, which is available to anyone that would love to access that. I must say everything in Lesotho is virgin. It hasn't been disturbed. So investors can take advantage of that.
So, Mr. Prime Minister, when I told some journalists that I was going to talk to you, one of the questions they asked me was, you are a businessman yourself before becoming a prime minister. How do you plan to make Lesotho very productive? That is the question they want to ask. So talk to me about how you intend to do that.
Peter.
Yes.
You are very right, my friend. I am a businessman at heart.
So what I want to do is, since I've now joined politics, I'm going to run Lesotho exactly as I used to run my businesses. I'm telling you, my wish is to turn Lesotho around, and it's going to happen. Yes, it's definitely going to happen.
How are you going to do it? Because, you know, sometimes businesses tend to be slightly different from a government machinery where sometimes things are pulling in different direction. And
no, it's quite easy. Even business is the same. You know, sometimes things are slightly different, as you say, but you pull them to the right direction, and finally it works.
So what is your vision for the people of Lesotho, Mr. Prime Minister?
My vision for Lesotho is to be a country that will be stable, sustain itself, because we are looking, one of our main priority is to get into production. You know, production in a way that we can be able to produce and export, but at the same time, sustaining ourselves as a nation. Yes. There are some things that you can look at. Currently, we have water in Lesotho, which we are exporting to our neighbor. We want to, currently, we are exporting water to South Africa. We are in talks now with Botswana about doing the same with them as well. Yeah.
Why do you think the people of Lesotho decide to choose you or choose your party as the governing party?
I believe it's all because of my proven record in business. And people had already lost hope due to the past, what happened, you know, to them. Politicians promising them this and that, which never materialized. But now I believe the Basotho people have hope. That's why we can. There's no room for disappointment for them, and we won't let that happen.
You are a very prominent businessman. You gave a lot of things out, and perhaps it's because your philanthropical work that contributed to your victory. Yeah. What say you?
True. You need to prove yourself, you know, because talking and proving yourself is two different things. People want to see. They don't want to hear anymore because they have heard a lot of things which never turned their lives into, you know, in a better way. So they want to see. So they have seen what I've done. So I'm going to carry on doing what I was doing then. I'm carrying it forward.
Sam Matekane is the newly installed Prime Minister of Lesotho. He spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. Join us for the concluding part of the conversation with Prime Minister Matekane on Nightline Africa on Sunday. The U.S.-Africa Leadership Summit has ended. U.S. President Joe Biden, who hosted the 3 days of meetings, expressed Washington's commitment to deepen and expand partnership with African countries to, as he says, better meet shared challenges and opportunities. He also called on the 50 African leaders who participated in the summit to respect the will of their people, adding that he may visit the continent. Biden also pledged $50 billion in support to Africa. David Senge is Sierra Leone's Minister of Basic and Senior Secondary Education and Chief Innovation Officer for the Directorate of Science, Technology and Innovation. He was a keynote speaker at a panel discussion on the sidelines of the summit in Washington. I caught up with Senge to get his overall reaction to the talks.
One of the things that's been great is that we're looking at a new way of engaging, new forms of partnerships between America and African states. And that's a new form of partnership based on a shared vision, based on trust, based on mutual accountability, and our responsibility really to a better world. And that is new for me, because it's not that we're sitting at a table and expecting that the U.S. will come give aid. We're speaking investment. Mm. It's another conversation about aid. We're speaking investment. We're speaking about the future, a shared future. We're speaking about accountability and respect. And what, for me, I found most important and interesting is our commitment to the youth and unemployment and education and about the future.
Mm. Did you speak with some of the investors here about investing in Sierra Leone's education, especially the young ones or the youth?
It's actually quite interesting because we, if you think about how much Sierra Leone commits to education, 22% of our budget.
Right.
Now, if you think about the aid, the loan, the debt that we have to pay, and with the depreciation of the leones against the dollar, and with the global economic crisis, you see that our 22% does not go as far.
Mm.
So one of the things that we have been speaking about, both on the government side and with our partner side, is how do we engage differently such that Sierra Leone, with its 22% in education, or any other country, that can go further than it currently is going.
Mm-hmm.
How do we bring in resources from other sectors to be able to support? And for education in particular, it's, if we're thinking about digital education, there's some private sector organizations who we've been speaking about. If we're speaking about ways of teacher training and technology and these different ways in which we can ensure that people are getting training, are getting the learning outcomes that are desired.
So with the participation at this summit, what impact do you anticipate it having? Because I see a whole delegation from Sierra Leone engaging with a lot of the partners here.
My hope is that there are many other people from here who will have a new insight into Sierra Leone and who will come to Sierra Leone. It's also just engaging. The President Biden mentioned the Prosper Africa, the mm-hmm. virtual deal room.
Mm-hmm.
For example, we engaged with that. It's not just about you come here, it's the in-person matters, you create relationships, but most of the work can happen virtually after mm-hmm. that. So how do you engage on those platforms to ensure that you're bringing in the right set of information to the and the right set of data to the investor, such that you can move those forward? So I'm very hopeful. I think our team is very committed to pursuing these partnerships and making sure that that impact is felt on the ground in Sierra Leone.
Looking at the 22% budget that the president has budgeted for education, what are some of the success stories you are seeing on the ground? And in the future, how sustainable would this free education be?
I think when you think about how you transform a country, you have to base it on the foundation. In the past, and when you, in politics, bad politics, you take all the money and you build one big pillar. You say, look at that tall pillar that I built in 4 years. What we have done in this government is to say, we need sustainable development. That requires a solid foundation. We dig down into the hole, bring rocks, and put solid multiple core pillars. And so you may not see it go as high, but what we are building is so structural that it doesn't matter. We can only go up. Different people can focus on different sides of the wall because the foundation is solid. That said, we've been able to achieve gender parity within 4 years. There are more girls as boys. This was not the case.
At the end of this summit, what do you intend to take away to Sierra Leone, and how would this help as education minister to embolden to see your vision materialize in Sierra Leone?
I think it was great to hear the president talk about new forms of partnership based on our shared future. It was great that the president also spoke about MCC and Sierra Leone, had a meeting with the head of MCC, who said how Sierra Leone is one of their most important partners. We are eligible for Compact, and we are far into developing it, focused on energy. We saw the president speak about technology and innovation. I'm also chief innovation officer for Sierra Leone, and it's great to keep pursuing that technology and innovation is going to be the ways in which we transform our economies, not just in America as they have, but also in our various African countries. The focus on youth, the focus on climate, these are all very well in line with our human capital development initiatives that President Biya has.
David Senge is Sierra Leone's Minister of Basic and Senior Secondary Education and Chief Innovation Officer for the Directorate of Science, Technology and Innovation. He spoke with me from here in Washington.
direct from Washington, the voice of America, VOA.
Ugandan activist organized a demonstration to protest the participation of President Yoweri Museveni in the just-concluded U.S.-Africa Leadership Summit in Washington, D.C., citing human rights concerns, lack of political space for opposition groups, intimidation and harassment of critics of the administration. The protesters urged the U.S. government not to invite Museveni to future summits. Supporters of the government rejected the criticism. They called on security authorities in Uganda to arrest and prosecute those who threaten the country's peace and stability. Analysts say protests against the government in Kampala appear to be losing their effectiveness. They call on opposition groups to unite to effectively pressure the governing party. For more about the protest, I reach Karim Ntambi. He is one of the main organizers of the demonstrations.
So the protest is here to highlight what is going on in Uganda and also to remind the U.S. their commitment on democracy and human rights. So we cannot have the Museveni, who has been there for more than 36 years in Uganda. There has been an increase in the abductions and enforced disappearances of innocent civilians. So we cannot come to Washington and speak about human rights and democracy while people in Uganda are being held incommunicado.
But Karim, the president was voted for and people participated. Well, he just won re-election and he keeps defeating these young challengers. So why do you call him names when obviously he's winning elections?
Human Rights and Democracy Report by the State Department indicated irregularities during the elections. The opposition leader, Robert Kyagulanyi Ssentamu, was imprisoned during the election. Most of his campaign staff was abducted on the campaign trail. And up to now, those people have not received justice. Now, we can't say that people came out while others were being abducted. We can't say people came out while many were still in jail. We can't say people came out and voted from seven in big numbers while others were really killed. That is not justice. That's not democracy. Democracy should be held freely and fairly, not when somebody's hands are tied and the other one is ready to move freely.
But Karim, some supporters of the NRM are saying that those people who are trying to undermine the country's territorial integrity by creating confusion, by attacking unarmed civilians and breaking the law should be dealt with. And those are the people who are being dealt with. So why do you call the government names when it is mandated by the Constitution to protect life and property of all Ugandans?
Okay, recently the former Inspector General of Police, Kale Kaihura, has been sanctioned not only by the Treasury Department here, but also by the UK government. Abel Kandiho was also sanctioned. So it shows that the people at the top have been managing. Museveni himself admitted that Honorable Kyagulanyi Ssentamu was brutally beaten. And for him, it was a fair beating. That's his statement on that. It was a fair beating, irrespective of the fact that Bobi Wine's bodyguard, Yasin Kauma, had been killed in the camp. Museveni said that was fair for him to do that. So we cannot, it's not like we're just gaslighting, but this is something that has been going on for 36 years. 36 years is enough. And we hope that this will be the last time Museveni comes to the United States.
People are saying that these protests have lost their value and their effectiveness. How do you respond to that?
The Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International reported. The U.S. State Department of State has also made reports. There has also been independent reports from different political parties on the not only the irregularities that happened in the elections, but also in the torture of individuals, journalists like Kakwenza, young women who have been killed, like Rita Nabukenya, who was ran over by a car. We cannot forget people who were killed in Luka during the campaign trail. So all those reports have been presented, and the U.S. has documented most of those reports. Unfortunately, we are here to call them for action. We cannot have reports written and being put on shelves.
Karim Intambi is a Ugandan activist and an organizer of the protest. He spoke with me from here in Washington. In Nigeria, the presidential candidate of the Opposition Action Alliance says the party's policies and growing popularity will ensure victory in the February general election. Hamza al-Mustafa, who was the chief security officer for Nigeria's former head of state, Sani Abacha, says he will implement measures to resolve insecurity concerns plaguing the country. Analysts say al-Mustafa faces stiff competition from former Lagos State Governor Asiwaju Bola Ahmed Tinubu, presidential candidate for the ruling All People's Congress, or APC, former Vice President Atiku Abubakar from the main opposition People's Democratic Party, or PDP, and former Governor of Anambra State, Peter Obi, from the Labour Party. In an interview with me, presidential candidate al-Mustafa says he remains confident in the solutions he is proposing to solve the prevailing economic and security challenges facing Nigeria, which he says will catapult him to election victory.
We did not just plunge ourselves into the race, other than the fact that we took time, 5 years, 8 months, into an in-depth research of Nigeria's past, and then the present challenges, and then the opportunities open to Nigeria. We are confident of who we are and what we are standing on. Therefore, in a nutshell, we know Nigeria's problems, and we have the solutions in our hands.
If you are elected as the next president of Nigeria within 100 days, what would be the three major things you would set into motion to accomplish in Nigeria?
Within the first 100 days are five issues. One, reestablishment of the already identified friends around the world, and with them in resensitizing and redirecting Nigeria's future international interest. Number two is also the revival of institutions in Nigeria that were deliberately killed. Number three is a means we have already, in the course of our researches, investigations led us into what to do with Nigerian resources in the shortest time possible to have the resources to begin away from yesterday's programs or programmed activities that turn our past leaders into robotic attitudes.
What makes you uniquely qualified to become Nigeria's next president?
As far as Nigeria is concerned, you want to provide leadership to her. You must be seen to know her past. You must have been a victim of persecution in trying to better Nigeria by whichever group. You must also be seen to now know carefully into secret leadership qualities that many people are not aware of. You must understand the past, and you must also understand Nigeria's groupings and alignments that keep reoccurring intermittently. You also should understand the peculiar problems of the classes, those above the law and those below the law, and know how to carry all along and plan for the country.
The issue foremost on Nigerians' minds are security and the prevailing economic conditions. What specific measures will you put in place, A, to address the security challenges, and two, to address the economic malaise?
First of all, the security. The security will have a big package that I consider confidential. And then it will answer all fronts. At the surface is the failures of the systems that we have. We identified them and we know where they went wrong or where it all went wrong. And we also know that we are creating many things. So there will be complementary roles, there will be central coordination, there will be complements from electronic services into physical security. So therefore, all I'm trying to tell you in a nutshell is that from passive to active security, Nigeria shall have something new that will be all encompassing, from our borders to the hinterland, to our waters, and then to the relationship between Nigeria and the countries that surround us. We will secure this country. Investors, citizens will be happy that they have a country that is fully secured and a place to do business.
Hamza al-Mustafa is the presidential candidate of the Nigerian Opposition Action Alliance. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Michael Harvey, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. Up next is the podcast about the World Cup.
Sporty World Cup greetings to all our Voice of America viewers and listeners. Welcome to episode 5 of On Goal with Sonny and Muckbill. I'm Sonny Young. I'm joined here in Studio 2 by Muckbill Yabarrow. Sporty World Cup greetings, Muckbill.
Sporty World Cup greetings to you too, Sonny. What's going on, man?
Gotta start with your jersey, Muckbill. I see Paris Saint-Germain right on your chest. PSG, they're going to be front and center on Sunday in Qatar.
If I was a betting man, I'd say that somebody from PSG is going to win. Definitely, I think it's going to be huge for PSG, having both their top guys going at it head-to-head, both top scorers in the World Cup as well. For a club to have that type of honor in the World Club is huge. And PSG was already a big club, but they are on Front Street right now.
Well, we're going to talk about Messi and Mbappe and Sunday's World Cup final. But first, let's look at the third place match, Muckbill, between Croatia and Morocco. Both teams, I think, want to leave Qatar with that third-place medal around their necks. Your thoughts on the third-place match?
Yeah, Sonny, they definitely say it is the most important game that players don't want to play, right? Right? So it's like, it's super important. You don't want to get all the way there and get fourth place. You still want to go out on the podium, right? Bronze is not too bad. You'll take it. But I definitely feel like this is almost like a grudge match. This was the very first game that both teams had played in their group stages.
That's right.
Ending that game in 0-0 because within the group stages, you can finish off in a draw. There's no draw now. So we'll see which one of these two teams wants it more. Morocco having never been to this stage before historically. And Croatia just off of the last World Cup being runners-up. So they definitely wanted to win it all in order to redeem themselves from the last World Cup. But hey, third is still better than fourth, so we'll definitely see. I think they're both going to really come out gunning.
I agree. I think they're going to play with a lot of pride and passion. Let's give the props to the Atlas Lions of Morocco, the Cinderella story at this first World Cup in the Middle East. The Atlas Lions lost to France in the semifinals by a score of 2-0. I felt like that scoreline, Muckbill, was a bit deceptive that, you know, I thought Morocco played very well in that semifinal.
Yeah, I think so as well. You know, unfortunately, Morocco has been plagued throughout the tournament with constant repeat injuries on their back line, especially with their captain, Roman Cies, and numerous other players on the back end, Mazraoui. You can name so many of them. And unfortunately, because of that setup, what we once knew as that back line of defense for the Moroccans that really only had Hakimi staying strong now had so many different gaps, and the French were able to exploit it as early as what, 5 minutes?
Fifth minute
was Hernandez. And another thing also is when you don't have your go-to players in position and then you're going up against Kylian Mbappe, right, who, if you even remember, both goals that France scored were created by him. It won't show up on the stat sheet because it wasn't really an assist, but you had four, maybe five Moroccans defending him. He shoots the ball. Either a ricochetzer comes off, and Hernandez and Kolo both were just on the receiving end of both those to score those goals. So it's tough. It looked a lot. The scoreline doesn't really show the game, I think.
And I think psychologically, that early goal by Hernandez, it put the Moroccans on their heels. And even after the match, the head coach of Morocco, Regragui, he said that was his biggest regret, giving up a goal that early in the match. And I was thinking that was really the first goal that team gave up to an opposing player in the tournament. Yeah. Because the earlier one was an own goal.
Right, right. No, but it's really sad, though, because when you really looked at how that Moroccan team has been playing throughout the entirety of the tournament, right, they've been playing exceptionally well from the goalkeeper position, defender position. You know, they've been really locked down. Their back line has been excellent. And for that fifth-minute goal to have happened, any other team, though, Sonny, I think, honestly, would have been deflated. They, in turn, actually turned on the Jets. And if I wasn't mistaken, the first half, they really had more ball possession than France. And you didn't know who was the reigning champs. Because possession was with them. They were creating a lot more shots. But the French almost turned their game on them, right? They did what Morocco was able to do to Portugal, right? Get that goal. Let's get in defense. Everybody was back on defense, whether it's Mbappe was playing defense. You know, you have Griezmann playing defense, you know, Giroud. Guys that you're not expecting to be back there were really all in there and making sure that the Moroccans did. And they had a lot of great opportunities, just couldn't get it.
First team from Africa to reach the Final Four. And now, Mukbil, I got to believe the Atlas Lions have really given Africa hope of maybe lifting that trophy very soon.
I think so. Another point that I would even make is I think they've given specific players maybe the confidence to go back home and want to play for, you know, an African side maybe. You know, we have the French side now who have a large portion of their team are descendants of Africans, right? They might have been first generation or parents immigrated there to France. And who's to say if these players don't kind of say, hey, we might want to go back and play for, you know, our parents' country or our country or where our lineage was from. I definitely think that these type of moments are what kind of inspires this for the African players. So it's going to be interesting to see.
And African players, African coaches, I know we've talked about this, Mukbil, but all five African teams led by African coaches, local coaches. This Regragui for Morocco, yeah, he's been in charge, I think, only like 4 months.
Yeah.
I mean, what a transformation with that team.
Right. I even think this Moroccan side was a team that had lost to the U.S. side not even too long ago.
That was their last loss, right. I believe.
Yeah. Was it in June? It was earlier on in the year. But if you would have told me that that team would have made it to the semifinals, I don't think so. And I also believe that Ziyech had a quarrel or an issue with the former coach. And I guess they stayed with Ziyech. You know, he's a huge, huge playmaker for them. He's been huge the entire tournament, and I feel like it paid off for them.
We talked about Hakimi a little bit. I like the both before and after the match. He was hugging his PSG teammate.
Yeah, I think Hakimi and Mbappe are really good friends off the field, and you know they play for the same side, PSG. They go against each other every day because of the positions that they play, right? So if anybody had an opportunity to try to slow down Mbappe, it would have been Hakimi. And in certain instances, he tried to do what he could to contain him. But the problem with a player of Mbappe's magnitude is when you throw everybody at him, he now creates open opportunities for everyone else. Hence why, you know, Hernandez and Kolo were both able to score these two almost one-on-one situations where they were by themselves. It was just them and the goalie. So, you know, that's another thing about when you have a class player like that. So Mbappe definitely makes the game very, very easy for everybody else around him because he requires so much attention.
As we look at this Moroccan team, Mukbil, I think we have to give props also to their fans.
Yeah.
Perhaps the loudest fans at the World Cup. They traveled from Morocco to Doha to see their team play, and just a great, great crowd.
Yeah, talk about a 12th man, right? People were saying they couldn't even hear themselves. I have some friends of mine that went to some of the games, and they were saying it was so loud to the point where the person next to you, you wouldn't be able to hear them if you were just talking. You know, you can imagine what that does for a team. And even after going down 1-0 in the first 5 minutes, they were still chanting. You know, I think that's really where the players got their energy from. It was like, look, we're here to see you guys. There's 85 minutes left. Let's go. Let's do something. And they really played well. There's a bicycle kick. One, I remember.
That was spectacular.
That could have been.
Just missed.
Could have been.
Hit the post.
But, you know, kudos to the French goalkeeper. Got his hands on it just enough to get it on the crossbar. But, man, they had a lot of shots, man. A lot of opportunities.
I know our producer, Mike, that likes to talk about woulda, coulda, shoulda. Well, that could have been the best goal of the tournament, but
it could have. It wasn't though. It was quite a save though. It was quite a save. You got to give it to him. So, yeah, man. Honestly, let's run by Sonny. If we'd have to say some of the top upsets in the tournament, what would your choice be?
Well, you know, Argentina is in the final on Sunday against France. I got to go with Saudi Arabia beating Argentina in the opening match. I know there were some offside calls against Argentina, but still, we're talking about spectacular goals. There was a great goal in that game. It was almost a bicycle kick by the Saudi player, but it was a great way to start the tournament, I think.
Oh, absolutely. I feel like that's a great choice. If you really think about it, the Saudi team, I think, had maybe 3 shots on goal.
Unreal.
You know, so it's like, talk about efficiency, right? You got to make sure, and both goals were class, I think, because the Argentinian back line is nothing to play with as well. They were on it. Both goals, you had to really, like, pin the knee. You just looked at it. You had to get the exact angle at the exact moment, kick it with such little spacing. You have no room for error. They made a count. 2 goals. It was back-to-back. And we got to think about it. Messi had a PK. I believe it was around the 10th minute. So it's like you're down 1-0 to Argentina in your opening game. Talk about overcoming adversity, right? You come out and just
second half.
You know, you could have been deflated. Argentina was already in a defensive mode because they already had the goal. So what do you do? How do you respond? I don't think anybody expected that from Saudi Arabia. So that was stellar.
Another I guess it's an upset, the early exit of Germany in the tournament. I didn't see them going out in the group stage.
In that group stage, I don't think anybody had Japan not only beating Germany, but coming out on top in that group, right? Because you're thinking to yourself, you have a group with Germany and Spain. I know they didn't have any groups of death, but if I was to choose one, that looked like a scary group. You know, Morocco's group was pretty bad too. Croatia, Belgium, and Morocco and Canada. So I think that was also a pretty tough group as well.
Well, let's talk about that other semifinal muck, Bill. Argentina beating Croatia 3-0. We'll look back a little bit. I think you told me right before the podcast that they kind of flipped the score line last time these teams played at the World Cup in the group phase in 2018. Croatia beat Argentina 3-0. I certainly expected a closer match than what we saw, and Messi was just spectacular.
Yeah, I think we spoke about it too before the game. We both thought it was going to be a closer game just because we've seen what the Croatian side has done from a defensive stand. This has been a World Cup of defenses. You know what I mean? Like, the back lines have been super impressive with the teams that have made it really far, with the exception to the French, because the French have allowed a goal in every single game except for against that Morocco game, oddly. But they just outscore you, right? But, Croatia, Argentina, I thought it was going to be a closer game. But as we've seen, Messi really stepping up to it. Another interesting fact has been Argentina's tied, I believe, for the most penalties awarded in this World Cup as well.
Okay.
They've had 4. I believe Messi scored 3 and missed 1. That just goes to show you. Of his 5 goals, you know, he's had 3 PKs. They are very difficult to score in moments of high pressure. So I'm not going to say these are gimmies, you know, as we've seen with Harry Kane, you know, have Oh, man, talk about that. That game was, yeah.
Yeah, that was a bad miss.
He's going to remember that for 4 years, I tell you that, man.
Muckbill Yabaro, I'm Sonny Young. You're on goal with Sonny and Muckbill. We'll be right back after this break.
It is the biggest sports event of the year, the 2022 World Cup in Qatar. Join VOA to celebrate Africa's king sport. In-depth coverage, breakout stars, Cinderella teams, coaches, players, and let's not forget the fans from the four corners of the continent and from the city of Doha. Don't miss the fun with Team VOA Africa. Let's experience the magic of football together.
The magic of football. I'm Sonny Young, joined by Muckbill Yabaro here in Studio 2 at our Voice of America headquarters in Washington. You're on goal with Sonny and Muckbill. Muckbill, as we look forward to Saturday's third place match, who, in your opinion, have been the key players for the Atlas Lions of Morocco at this World Cup?
Ooh, so you definitely have to go with goalkeeper Yassine Benou, only having allowed opposition goals to the French of all the entire games. There's an own goal that was scored by one of his defenders as well early on. So he's played spectacular. You have Amrabat, who President Emmanuel Macron, after the French game, went into the locker room with the Moroccans and told everybody that Amrabat has been the best midfielder in the entire tournament. That's huge praise, you know. Granted, he's not a FIFA official or he doesn't own a team, I don't believe. But nonetheless, you know, hearing that from a president is huge. But I think a lot of people would also say he really was under the radar as a midfielder and statistically has been one of the most solid midfielders the entire tournament. You have another midfielder on the Moroccan side, Unahi, who's also their number eight, who's been amazing as well. He definitely, a lot of big teams are looking at him. He might be making his move to the EPL. So we will see.
And I want to give a shout out for En-Nesyri. En-Nesyri scored on the header for Morocco. And
Ziyech as well.
Ziyech and Regragui, their coach, was saying a lot of the Moroccan journalists didn't want En-Nesyri on the World Cup team. They felt that he wasn't skillful enough. But that was a beautiful header.
That header had they swung the camera to Cristiano Ronaldo, and he just almost smirked at his face. He knew it was a quality goal. It looked very similar to a lot of headers that Ronaldo scored in his career because he got so much elevation on it. But definitely, the thing about the Moroccans is they have such an amazing team in totality, but you could say the one point that they are, I wouldn't say lacking, but could use more assistance in is that very front, right? And En-Nesyri has played well, but there's been moments where if you had maybe Mohamed Salah, right?
Right.
In a position like that, you would really make use of a lot of other opportunities. And then on top of it, once you take him out, who are his replacements? You had Walid Chedira, who comes in and kind of, you know, doesn't really do that great when En-Nesyri gets out of the game. A lot of missed opportunities, maybe two against the Portuguese. Then I think he also got two yellows. Second yellow was questionable, but he had got a red card. And then that game was just all up in the air at the very last couple of minutes on extra time. But all in all, I think this team was a very well-designed team. And they've shown Africa that, you know, it can be done on the World Cup stage.
And one shout-out for Luka Modric. He'll play in the third-place match, 37 years old for Croatia. Possibly his last international match for the Croatian team. Ballon d'Or winner in 2018. Just a great player. I know he was disappointed after that loss to Argentina, but we'll see what he does after Qatar.
Yeah, no, I think for sure it's his last World Cup. I don't think he plays another four at this level. You can even see certain games that went into extra time. Really, once you get to that certain age, it's like you can even see it with Messi, really, in certain games where they go beyond extra time. And it's just like you can't really play that long, you know, at that elite of a level when you're playing against 19, 20-year-olds, 21-year-olds. But I think, you know, Luka has done some amazing things with his career. One of the oldest Ballon d'Or winners as well, him and Benzema, I believe, being first-time Ballon d'Or winners in their 30s. It's huge. So I know he definitely wants to go out with the win. So it's going to definitely be a battle between Croatia and Morocco. It'll be an exciting game for sure.
Mukbil, you mentioned Benzema, and he was one of three French players injured prior to the World Cup, along with Pogba and N'Golo Kanté. I understand Benzema kind of made a late plea to get into Sunday's final.
I think a question was posed to Coach Didier Deschamps, and it was almost to the extent of, hey, Benzema's ready to go. What do you do with him? Or do you let him play? And he just said, next question. So I think there was push also from President Macron to want to have Benzema, Pogba, and Kanté and some of these injured players to come and be a part of the celebratory action to help support the team. But I could understand from both parties, you know, I know Benzema, this is possibly his last World Cup playing at this level. Having won the Ballon d'Or, I think he would have performed well in this World Cup. But then Coach Deschamps is seeing that his team has, you know, now garnered this level of chemistry that you can't really, you put in a player like Benzema who requires a lot of touches, who can score for you at an elite level, but what do you do? Who do you take out? You know, and that person that you take out, could it be a possibility that maybe he's informed but not informed to play at a final? Because you're just throwing him in. He doesn't have a chance to warm up or anything. Put him in the big stage and let him play. But if he doesn't perform, what happens?
Right.
You blame Benzema. You blame Coach Deschamps. I think it's as unfortunate as it is, I would love to see him in the World Cup stage. But I think Coach made the right decision.
We talked right at the top about those PSG superstars, Mbappe and Messi. How much do you think this final is about those two players? Or do you see maybe some other players picking up the slack on Sunday in the final?
I think obviously you have to put Messi and Mbappe up there. Messi is doing it for his country, his legacy, arguably one of the greatest ever. But he hasn't been able to do it on a world stage for his national side. Mbappe, at age 19, was able to get it done for his team.
Amazing.
Last year, wants to go back-to-back and be the best and continue to be the best player in the world. Then you got the other subplots, right? You have Alvarez with 4 goals.
one of the younger players on Argentina.
Younger Argentinian player. Plays for Man City. Plays behind Haaland, who is another stellar stud, you know what I mean, of Norwegian descent. Then you have on this other side now, Oliver Giroud. He just surpassed Thierry Henry for the most goals scored on the French national side. He could be arguably the most underrated striker of this level because the man has won in so many levels, right? Whether it's La Liga, Serie A, like World Cup, like what does he have to do for him to prove that he's supposed to be here?
In that semifinal against Morocco, every time Giroud would miss the shot or come close to scoring,
man,
see him lift his jersey up and just shake his head.
I remember one play, the ball bounced right over Cius because of his hamstring, wasn't really able to, he misjudged it. Giroud took that step left-footed and it hit the crossbar. It was a mean strike. That was going into the net, you know, just a couple centimeters. Coulda, woulda, shoulda.
Well, Mukbil, we mentioned Saudi Arabia beating Argentina in their opening match. Argentina has won every game since then. How much do you see Argentina and Messi as a team of destiny at this World Cup?
I think, you know, for every Messi fan out there, they believe that this is the one. Everything is aligning. And not only is it that Messi's a part of the team, he is an integral part of the team, right? He is their leading goal scorer. He is their leading playmaker. I believe he has 3 assists as well. So it's like he is doing everything that he needs to do to get the job done. And in other teams that he's played alongside when it was for his national team, unfortunately, they haven't had that cohesiveness or that chemistry or that quality, right? You have a guy like Alvarez who's right there with you. You can create for him and then have him score, or he knows what position he needs to be, and you don't have to almost, you know, baby him to get it done. So I think this has been the best team that he's been on. And I wouldn't say he's on the back. He is on the back end of his career. But what a way to ride off into the sunset.
Yeah, and I think he'll finally, if they win on Sunday, I'm talking about Argentina, I think Messi will, you know, he'll be closer to Maradona in terms of legacy and stature. He just hasn't been able to lift the cup.
Yeah, I think with Maradona and Argentina, there's this level of mystique, right? I think because of how long Maradona's been out of the game and that glory that Argentina's seen with him, it's almost as if it's like you're chasing a ghost, because Messi has done.
Good. I like that.
You know, Messi is
chasing
done,
a ghost.
Messi has done everything you could possibly do to play at an elite level everywhere, but for his national side. So I think if he gets this, because you got to look on the club side, Maradona hasn't played on the elite levels that Messi has and done certain things. The same quality of things that he's done, winning so many Ballon d'Ors and all these other things. So I think if he's able to get this, the conversation will be a lot closer. It's very similar to that Michael Jordan, LeBron yeah. conversation, right? You know, for our basketball viewers.
You mentioned Messi's assists in the tournament, and I think that's the tiebreaker.
Yeah.
Should he and Mbappe end up with 5 goals each?
Yeah.
I think it goes to how many assists you have.
It's possible. I think Mbappe has 2 assists at the moment, so maybe if he gets that second assist, then what happens? I mean, that third assist, what happens there? It's going to be interesting nonetheless. Also, we also posed the question of Giroud possibly scoring a goal or two, right?
What happened? Right.
Because if you've scored 5 goals, but your goal was for the World Cup to win it, you could take it. I would take precedence to that goal, I think, maybe, you know. I don't know. Alvarez could score too, so.
Well, we just have a few minutes left, Muckbill. What about African teams that didn't quite do as well as the Atlas Lions? Senegal, they made it to the round of 16 without Sadio Mane, and I give them full credit for how they performed.
I think if you have Sadio Mane playing in that role as lone striker, or possibly even just controlling mid, that's a completely different team, right? Because now the defense are required to be worrying about this world-class, you know, striker or midfielder, whatever position he decides to play, if he wants to create or if he wants to score. You remove that player, now you're able to guard maybe one-on-one on these other players who, you know, could be of quality, but it's just that they don't have... Sometimes when you have a bigger name player, it's not even so much about them performing. It's just about the fear of knowing what they could do. That, look at Morocco-France. Mbappe was being guarded maybe by 2 players at any given time. They were just watching, trying to like corral him, make sure that he doesn't get that space that he needs. Even Amrabat, who's been playing amazing for Morocco, one time it was him one-on-one. The pace is unreal. He couldn't catch up to him. And by the time that he caught up to him, he was able to do a slide tackle that really was one of the most amazing slide tackles that I've seen all tournament, where he got ball and still took him out. It was amazing, but it took him a while to catch up to him, you know? So, yeah, definitely. I think if Mane was there, that would be a completely different Senegal side. I don't know if he – does he play the next World Cup?
Yeah, his age, yeah. I think he'll be 34
yeah.
at the next World Cup.
Yeah.
One non-Moroccan player from an African team that really stood out in your eyes, Muckbill.
Mohamed Kudus.
Yeah, I have to go with him also.
For sure. That kid, man, he was the shining light for the Black Stars. You know, they weren't that highly favored, you know, coming into the tournament. But whenever he touched the ball, he was able to create opportunities. You know, he just showed his level of class playing for the Black Stars. And I think that that's just the beginning. You know, he plays for Ajax right now, which is a big Dutch club, but I think a lot of the bigger clubs are going to be very interested in him moving forward.
Muckbill Yabarrow, and I'm Sonny Young on goal with Sonny and Muckbill. We have reached the end of episode 5. There will be an episode 6 post World Cup, so please join us. Thanks to our producer Mike Hove, as well as our studio technician Mr. Chung. I'm VOA Sonny Young. Thanks, Muckbill.
Thanks, Sonny.
And we'll see you for episode 6.